Across Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. and Britain have announced a new restriction on carry-on electronic devices on planes coming from certain airports in the Middle East and Africa. The airports include Cairo, Istanbul, Kuwait City, Doha, Casablanca, Amman, Riyadh, Jeddah, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi. Deakin University analyst Greg Barton said it may be linked to a bomb that nearly brought down an aircraft on a flight from Mogadishu a year ago.
Look, it seems to be linked, obviously in the first instance, to the laptop-encased device used in Somalia that blew a hole in the side of the aircraft, killed the bomber, but didn't bring the aircraft down, fortunately.
He said it may also be the result of attempts by the jihadist group Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to bring down other aircraft. Passengers will not be allowed to bring into the main cabin devices larger than a mobile phone, including tablets, portable DVDs, laptops, and cameras. That said, Henry Hartevelt of Atmosphere Research Group will upset many passengers.
Travelers are going to be furious about this. This is an enormous inconvenience, and frankly, it creates a lot of stress to the traveler. It makes them more aware of the risk of harm that could happen, as well as just the inconvenience and hassle of having to put these very expensive devices in their checked luggage where they have no control over it for hours at a time.
It comes as the Trump administration seeks to implement a temporary ban on people traveling from six mostly Muslim countries until proper screening procedures can be put in place. Two executive orders by the president have been challenged in court. A car bomb killed at least five people and wounded several others at a checkpoint near the presidential palace in Mogadishu Tuesday. The jihadist insurgent group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility, the blast coming hours after Somalia's new prime minister announced a 26-member cabinet. This is VOA News. Turkey said Tuesday that officials will no longer attend rallies in Europe in favor of next month's Turkish referendum on sweeping new presidential powers. Hundreds of thousands of Turks in Europe are eligible to cast ballots. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused European leaders of Nazi-style tactics in canceling several of those rallies and barring Turkish officials from taking part. Mr. Erdogan was at it again Tuesday. Speaking in Ankara, he said Europe is racist, fascist, and tyrannical. International Affairs Professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver said Mr. Erdogan has been a big disappointment to many European leaders.
Everyone hoped that here was a Middle East state that was moderate, that was trying to become democratic, and to become pro-Western. And instead, what do we get from Tayyip Erdogan? We get this quote-unquote purge. Over 100,000 people have been detained. And now we have this referendum, which is the end of democracy in Turkey.
Relations between Turkey and the EU have soured in recent weeks, with Mr. Erdogan threatening to scrap a $6 billion migrant deal with Brussels. EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn Tuesday said Turkey's prospects for joining the EU are becoming increasingly unrealistic. Just 2 days before the next round of Geneva talks, Syrian rebels are on the move with a second assault in 3 days on eastern Damascus and a fresh attack on Hama in west-central Syria. The first assault by rebels in Damascus was blunted by armor-backed ground forces with air support. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the attack on Hama was being spearheaded by the alliance Tahrir al-Sham. Former South Korean President Park Geun-hye was grilled for 14 hours by prosecutors as part of an investigation into a corruption scandal that ended her presidency earlier this month. Ms. Park is accused of colluding with a friend to pressure big businesses to donate to two foundations set up to back her policies. She has expressed her apologies but has denied any wrongdoing. President Donald Trump Tuesday signed into law a bill that increases the budget of the space agency NASA.
I'm delighted to sign this bill. It's been a long time since a bill like this has been signed, reaffirming our national commitment to the core mission of NASA: human space exploration, space science, and technology.
The measure directs NASA to develop programs to get a crewed mission to Mars in the 2030s and explore the potential for human habitation on another celestial body. Meanwhile, a new study suggests Mars may have Saturn-like rings, according to models developed by researchers at Purdue University. The red planet was likely hit by an asteroid-type object. The debris from the impact may have become a ring before it evolved into a moon. U.S. stocks fell sharply Tuesday, with investors expressing concern about the ability of the Trump administration to deliver on tax cuts this year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN urges stakeholders in the DRC to implement last December's political agreement.
Only political solutions can address and stem the rising levels of violence now being witnessed in the DRC.
Mama Sidiku is the head of the UN mission in the DRC. Both the DRC government and the main opposition, Rassemblement, blame each other for the delay in implementing the December agreement. The outgoing UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations calls on South Sudan's government to silence guns and give peace a chance. And Cameroon refused a UN refugee agency allegations that the government is forcefully expelling Nigerian refugees.
Let me say this statement of the UN representative, we completely decry it, we completely refuse it. It is not accurate, it is not exact.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Communication. All African participants to a trade conference in Los Angeles were denied visas. And on World Water Day yesterday, there was little to celebrate in Zimbabwe about rainfall. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations warned on Tuesday that nearly 3 months after a political agreement was signed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, its implementation remains stalled, threatening security and stability. From the United Nations viewers, Margaret Bashir has more.
A bleak UN report chronicles spreading violence, including in previously stable areas, widespread human rights violations, mass graves, and the displacement of more than 2.2 million Congolese. The head of the UN mission in DRC, Maman Sidiku, warned Security Council members that tensions are mounting.
Only political solutions can address and stem the rising levels of violence now being witnessed in the DRC.
In December, President Joseph Kabila remained in power after his constitutional mandate expired, sparking unrest and reigniting fears that the country would slide backwards into violence and civil war. Congo is still trying to work its way through the political crisis towards elections later this year. But there have been significant obstacles. A deal signed between the government and opposition on December 31, 2016 has not been implemented. And in February, 84-year-old opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi died. There have also been disagreements between the two sides over designating a candidate for prime minister. Congo's foreign minister, Leonard Shea Okitundu, said the government has no intention of trying to delay implementation of the December 31st agreement and has already registered 12 million of an anticipated 41 million eligible voters. The UN has its largest and most expensive peacekeeping mission in the DRC and is working with the government to support a free, fair, and peaceful election process. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's government says the main opposition coalition, known as the Rassemblement, is to blame for the delay in the implementation of the December 31, 2016 agreement to end the country's political crisis. One of the accord provisions is the creation of a national unity government to be put together by a prime minister chosen by the Rassemblement. But a leading member of the opposition told VOA on Tuesday that President Joseph Kabila had slowed the process by demanding the opposition submits to him the names of three candidates from which he would choose which one should be the prime minister. DRC Information Minister Lambo Mende says it is the constitutional duty of the president to choose the prime minister. He blames the delay in implementing the agreement on opposition infighting.
I don't know who is responsible, but I know that the agreement was signed, but still we have to complete it with the arrangement to be signed to implement the agreement, and that arrangement needs that the opposition have to appoint the head of the government. And we know that there is some dispute within the opposition to decide who will represent them to the head of the government. So now we are waiting for them to present to the head of state the names of people among which the president will appoint the head of the government.
Mr. Minister, I did speak with Mr. Fayulu of the Rassemblement, and he indicated that perhaps part of the delay is because of President Kabila's insistence of the Rassemblement giving him three names from which he will nominate. But he said the agreement you signed December 31st last year said the Rassemblement must choose the prime minister.
I don't see what prevents them to give to President Kabila three names, as the constitution is saying that the president consults those who have to give the prime minister, so as the president can appoint the prime minister. It is not to them to appoint the prime minister. It is the consultation process. So they are denying to the president the right to consult them. They want to impose to the president a prime minister. That is unconstitutional. So they are the one who are not willing to give a chance to the country to end that situation.
I guess on the appointment of three persons to be given to President Kabila, I think one thing I heard from the viewpoint of the opposition is that perhaps President Kabila, as of the signing of the agreement of last year, he is about to leave power, so therefore they don't want to be giving him the names to pick the prime minister.
President Kabila is the president of the republic, is an institution, and the agreement says that the president consults those who will present the prime minister. So denying the president the right to consult them is not abiding by the agreement. And we think that they should follow what is written in the agreement, because the agreement refers to the constitution. And the president has the constitutional right to consult the opposition, as we have decided that the opposition is the group to designate to the president who will lead the government. So let them present to the president three names. The president asks them even 20 names, because he has the right to consult them. It is constitutional.
Lamba Mendes, Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, he was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Cameroon has refuted allegations by the UN Refugee Agency that Cameroon has forcefully expelled Nigerian refugees who fled Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria. In a press release on Tuesday, UNHCR expressed concern over what it called continuing forced return of hundreds of refugees from Cameroon to northeastern Nigeria, despite a recent tripartite agreement ensuring the voluntary return of the refugees. The UNHCR said so far this year, Cameroon has forcefully returned over 2,600 refugees back to Nigeria against their will. But Issa Chiroma Bakari, Cameroon's Minister of Communication, says the allegations are not corroborated by facts. He says Cameroon is committed to the March 2nd agreement respecting the voluntary return of Nigerian refugees. Chiroma Bakari also says the UN accusations are prejudicial to Cameroon national pride.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to answer what in the government we consider to be a statement which is not corroborated with facts. I would like to remind you that right now in my country, you have more than 360,000 refugees, almost 200,000 of them being Nigerian. So please, let me say this. This statement of the UN representative, we completely decry it. We completely refuse it. It is not accurate. It is not exact. What I would like to add is that in case they notice that there is something wrong, we are partners. And you remember that at the 2nd of March, Cameroon government and the Nigeria government, through their two interior ministers, they signed an agreement according to which the repatriation should be done willful of the refugee. No compulsory repatriation should take place. And Cameroon is this nation which observes and respects its commitment. The reason why I am very much surprised, this statement is far from reflecting the reality.
Mr. Minister, does your government believe that some of the refugees who have fled into your country could be of security risk?
First of all, it is not written on their face that they are Boko Haram sympathizer or activist. But when they arrive, accepted in our nation, day in, day out of their activism, what they do in the camp where they are harbored, it is always possible to detect them and to isolate them and send them back. You see, when we are dealing with those people, it is impossible forever to hide their identity.
The spokesperson for the UNHCR saying, for example, that in the process of sending these people back, their families have been separated, even some women forced to leave their children behind in Cameroon, suggesting that if this is the case, then it could be in violation of international law.
It is easy to accuse, although they cannot prove it. What interest do we have to separate parents with their children? What interest do we have? Nothing can explain such a statement. The reason why we say that this has caused a prejudice to our national pride and to our national honor. And we say that this statement is far from being friendly.
Is your government getting any help, say, from the UNHCR or the international community, the United Nations, for the effort your government is making to harbor these refugees? Are you getting any help?
We are looking forward to receiving help because this is a very huge burden, and this is bleeding, really bleeding our economy, our budget. This is not something that you can foresee in order to plan, in order to schedule it. Very recently, we received a representative of the 15 Security Council member in the United Nations. And after having congratulated Cameroon, they raised the issue of assisting us. And we say that any kind of assistance, financial, material, are always welcome, because really this is weighing very heavily on our shoulders, on our budget.
Issa Chiroma-Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Communication. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. The outgoing UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations says President Salva Kiir's government must first silence the guns across South Sudan if the president's proposed national dialogue is going to work. Speaking to reporters Tuesday in Juba, Hervé Lassus says the South Sudan government should resolve the problems facing the country in order to achieve a genuine consensus through national dialogue. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Hervé Lassus visited Juba along with his designated successor, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, to meet with President Salva Kiir and other top officials. Lassus describes security and humanitarian conditions in South Sudan as dire. He says the situation requires a political solution, and President Kiir's national dialogue is not a solution to South Sudan's many problems.
A national dialogue, of course, is most usefully held in a context where hostilities have ceased, that there is no more fighting, first. Second, that the humanitarian context is not perhaps as bad as it is right now. You know, when people are concerned about their very basic livelihood, maybe they don't have so much time to spare for political dialogue. Third, of course, it's also very important that the process be as inclusive as possible.
Lassus says the South Sudan government must drive the national dialogue toward a great consensus, saying it can be a catalyst for peace. At the same time, he warns open dialogue cannot be a substitute for a political solution to the fighting gripping the country. Lassus steps down as the UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations in 10 days. During his last visit to Juba as Undersecretary General, he urged all sides to implement the 2015 peace agreement, noting the UN is not pleased about the way the deal has been all but ignored. Lassus says the warring parties continue to block aid workers from accessing people in need of humanitarian assistance across the country.
We have faced at various points a number of impediments in terms of freedom of movement, in terms of freedom of getting clearances. Very importantly, the humanitarian actors have been severely impeded in their action on the ground.
Latsus says South Sudan is one of those countries in the world where there is the most incidence of humanitarian workers being prevented from doing their work, where workers are actually killed trying to help the most needy. Latsus says the African Union, the United Nations, and other stakeholders of the peace deal continue trying to engage the warring parties to end the fighting and fully implement the agreement. Without mentioning dates, Latsus says he expects the first wave of the UN-backed regional protection force to be deployed to South Sudan within weeks.
We are sparing no effort to speed up, and I think I can say that in the next few weeks you will see the first vanguard of the regional protection force being deployed actually here in Juba.
Latsus says tomorrow when he arrives in New York, he will attend another meeting on the status of those deployments, which he calls very important. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The University of Southern California each year hosts the African Economic and Development Summit, bringing delegations of African business leaders, government officials, and others to network with their counterparts in the U.S. But this year, the African Summit has no Africans. All were denied visas. Michelle Quinn reports from Los Angeles.
The African Economic Summit is usually an opportunity for people to network and talk about trade between the U.S. and Africa. But not many people are here this year, says event organizer Mary Flowers.
Usually we get about 40% that get rejected, but the others come. This year it was 100%, every delegation. And it was sad to see because these people were so disheartened of what happened.
This is the fourth year Flowers has put on this African trade and development event. But U.S. embassies in African countries denied attendees visas. About 100 people by her estimation. The countries affected included Sierra Leone, Guinea, Ghana, Nigeria, Ethiopia, and South Africa.
These kinds of things happen that makes it very difficult and challenging for us to connect.
Flowers doesn't know why all of the Africans heading to her event were denied visas this year, but she suspects it has something to do with the broader visa and travel controversy under President Trump. She's appealed to current and former lawmakers, including former Congresswoman Diane Watson.
There are ambassadors that were scheduled to be here at this summit that were denied visas. They rejected their visas. As you know, under the current administration, they are limiting the number of people who come from the continent of Africa into America, and they're denying the visas.
Watson says she has called the State Department to ask for information, but the State Department isn't allowed to discuss individual visa cases. There have been reports of U.S. embassies worldwide denying more travel visas, but it's hard to know for sure. The available State Department data only goes up to last fall.
I have to say that most of us feel that it is a discrimination issue with the African nations because we experience over and over and over. And the people that are being rejected are people that are legitimate business people with ties to the continent.
People were hoping to do business here, but not much has happened. And organizers vowed to get to the bottom of it. For Voice of America at the University of Southern California, this is Michelle Quinn.
Zimbabwe received higher than normal rainfall this year, but as the world commemorated this year's World Water Day yesterday, there was little cause to celebrate. A civic organization that fights for the right to water says a low percentage of Zimbabweans has access to clean water. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, the United Nations says it is making efforts to ensure the precious resource props up the country's backbone, agriculture.
For the first time in 2 years, Zimbabwe has received an above-normal amount of rain. But with that came an outbreak of typhoid in January, and last week, cholera claimed two lives. Program manager Good Life Mudzingwa works for Community Water Alliance, a civic organization that deals with issues of water governance in Zimbabwe. Mudzingwa says there is nothing to celebrate come World Water Day this Wednesday.
Basically, there is nothing to celebrate in terms of water. In terms of availability, there's nothing that we can say has been made. And it also relates to the fiscal commitment in terms of the budgetary provision by the government to realize that right. Our previous analysis has shown that 0.4% has been committed to water provision. So when we look at all those components, it's an expression that there's nothing in terms of realization of the human right to water.
The right to water has been in Zimbabwe's constitution since 2013. But for 36-year-old Chipoma Swinga, enjoying that right is still far away. Two or three times a week, she says she's about 30 meters down the Mkuwisi River from a busy bridge in Harare. With infant daughter Esther on her back and four-year-old son Emmanuel nearby, she's doing laundry using river water. Upstream, industrial and human waste flow into the river, which organizations like Community Water Alliance have been complaining about to authorities. She says residents have no taps, so they use the river. And for 7 to 8 years, the authorities have not talked about providing water. She says drinking water comes from an open well, but the community would rather get clean water from boreholes. She adds they want good living and access to clean water since it is the people's source of life. For Zimbabwe, water is also the cornerstone of the country's mainstay, agriculture. That is why the UN Food and Agriculture Organization says it is happy that Zimbabwe received above normal rainfall this year.
Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
London-based designer Yinka Ilori found inspiration in his parents and their Nigerian parables for one of his most recent projects. Parable Chair Collection features chairs that illustrate various parables. Ilori spoke to Ricky Stryak about the stories behind his funky furniture.
So the Parable Chair Collection was something that's always been inspired from my parents. My parents, you know, growing up, were always quite influential in my life and lives of my brothers and sisters. And they always spoke to us in riddles, Nigerian parables, and told us lots of stories about, you know, about being good and about being positive and not being jealous of people. And just an all-round, you know, collection of parables that make you feel, you know, you should be this type of person. And what I wanted to do was retold these parables through the chairs, through an object. Because I feel, you know, chairs are quite powerful objects. And, you know, as people, we sometimes take them for granted. So I wanted to try and retell the narratives of my parents through a chair.
And the narratives are of Nigerian origin?
They are, yeah. So these, you know, these parables were told to my parents, you know, from their parents, my grandparents. And Nigerians, they love parables because they're, you know, if you've ever been to Nigeria before, and someone speaks to you about something serious or anything serious or not so serious, they always end with a parable, a words of wisdom. So I just felt, you know, these parables are so prominent in Nigeria and, you know, lives of a lot of people. And I wanted to share those parables with people around the world because I feel they can, you know, they're quite thought-provoking and can change people's lives.
Can you give me one example of a certain chair and what parable it tells through its design in this collection of yours?
So there's one chair called A Trapped Star. And the parable behind that chair is no matter how long the neck of a giraffe is, it still can't see the future.
That was Yinka Ilori, a London-based designer. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. And that's it for this Wednesday, March 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that everyone in Africa will have a very, very good day.
Hello, I'm your host Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Africa land reform. The World Bank says that Africa needs to change its systems for buying and selling land. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.